Dustin, we saw some of the Mike Wilmot podcast that you did, and it's good to be on a licensed podcast.
Yes, right. This podcast is costing me a fortune to get to have that license.
Well, it sounded like he and Lomo were blind, so we went, let's get involved.
And then we started recording.
Is that what you...
It seems to now. It seems to work that way now. It never started off that way, but they have set a new precedent that people want to live up to. You know, the thing I wanted to bring up first is, you might not know the story, the first gig I ever did with Judith was a very exciting moment because it was a big lineup. Linda Gibson, Sue Ann Post, and it was in Adelaide, and it was in a place called Heaven, which is the name of the place, but it doesn't live up to that title. And it
would
just...
that be a gay venue?
No, but it should be.
Okay.
But it coincided with the death of Princess Diana, and we performed in this venue that could seat hundreds, and we performed to 70, I think. And it was a young Will Anderson.
Right.
I was in the duo, the Bunza Boys, so we had our jingle jangle. And it was this, you ended up performing, you got off the stage. I'd never actually seen a comedian do this before, where it's like, you can step off the stage. And you walked down into the bit where people were just kind of scattered around the dance floor and did your performance down there. And that was the first time I met you and the first gig that I ever did with you.
You see, having been doing this for such a long time, I have so many nights brimful of disappointment.
Yeah. Yes.
That is just one of the many, Justin. One of the many where you've turned up and there was hardly anyone there.
Yeah, right.
Someone famous had died, so everyone was feeling blue. You know, the fact that, as did happen to be on one occasion, you know, someone didn't go on radio the next day and say that they hated my act so much they wanted to take me out the back of the building and punch me in the face.
Right.
See, that's just a... So that gig was a bonus in many respects.
That actually worked out quite well in the long run.
Yeah, yeah, that was a win-win.
Have you ever had something like that happen, Tony, where someone famous dying has ruined all charts of ha-ha?
I don't think so, but I was on... Judith and I did a show at the Star Club in Adelaide.
Oh, yeah, that was 94, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that with Mick?
Yes.
I saw that show.
It's a bunker, basically. Yeah. It's a concrete bunker. And what I remember about that is the dressing room was the size of a phone box, and we were sharing it with the Tokyo Shock Boys.
Right, yeah. That was big on Hey Hey It's Saturday.
They were mostly pyrotechnics. So we were we would be watching Mick Molloy on stage, and we would be standing terrified of moving because every shelf contained explosives, firecrackers, you know, petroleum.
It was a good old-fashioned fringe venue where electrical cables were hanging loose and, you know, asbestos in one corner,
Health and safety nightmare.
Although I have to say, I actually shared a dressing room with the Jim Rose Freak Show, Adelaide Fringe Festival, and that was a lot more confronting simply because of the nudity.
Yeah, right.
There were just a lot of tattooed, naked people in that dressing room.
Yeah.
It was a kitchen, basically.
People getting weights from their testicles.
From their genitals, right. Yes.
Lifto. I saw that show.
There you go.
I saw that show off the back of... They were on The X-Files.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And that's why I went to see them. And halfway through the show, you're thinking, why am I here? Because it was, you know, like there was things like putting liquids into the stomach, regurgitating them, and getting someone out of the audience to drink them. And I don't know. I'm just a
I did a tap dance that year, and I felt that that was pushing the boundaries.
That was enough?
But clearly, no.
Did you get to hang out with them?
Not really, although they were very friendly, but I just found them quite scary.
Yeah.
And I had to change as well. And so I'm trying to be Little Miss Catholic modest in front of people who are just walking around completely naked.
And chockers full of the tattoos as well.
Very much.
Before it was cool and hip, when it was actually a little bit more audacious to have a tattoo.
Mr. Jigsaw, was it?
Yeah. Right. And I think if he really likes you, he tells you a piece that you can get as a tattoo, and then you kind of tattoo brothers.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a hell of a pickup line.
Here's an opportunity.
But in the 90s, do you remember there was like, who's the bloke that swallowed light bulbs and brought them up?
Stevie Starr, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mr. Methane.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was the Jim Rose Circus, Puppetry of the Penis. There was just self-abuse was really the go. Puppetry of the Penis, I see, still performing at the Comedy Festival.
3D.
You just can't keep two men down.
No, literally, I mean, you cannot.
The idea with a festival is you're meant to have new material every year.
Well, theirs is in 3D now.
But really? Surely it's just
But how
variations.
Many Ds was it in before?
Well, I actually spoke to Simon in Adelaide about it, and he's... you know, he was into it. Like, he's really into it. But it's young people now. It's franchised,
right,
you know. So
right.
it might not be new tricks, but it's new penises.
Right. He'll never have children that bad, will he?
You know what? I asked him. You know, it's always been that thing of people would say, you know, they can't get erections anymore. You know, they've done damage and they're scarred and all that kind of stuff. And so I asked him, and he had never heard that people talk about that. He'd never heard that rumour. And he said, no, it's all working fine. And that was as far as I needed to go with that conversation.
Good. But that's as much as I need to know.
Yes.
But I think for any man, really, no matter how much money you were making, if the side effect was not being able to get erections anymore, I think you'd do something else.
I reckon at a certain age I'd be fine with it.
a way off.
Yeah.
Surely, Justin.
Surely at least 6 months. That is...
But how long can they keep going? I mean, surely they're just working with, like, a stretched, distended piece of plasticine.
Yeah.
Now.
And there's only so... It's like, you know, there's only so many jokes reworked in different ways. There's only so many tricks. You know,
well,
there's
a hamburger and a
sailboat and then
that's
variations.
Right. And I remember saying to him years ago, surely the way to develop this act would be to introduce props. And he went, no, we're purists.
Oh.
They don't want to go down the gimmicks route.
Right.
This isn't gimmicky as it is.
Yeah. I saw a burlesque performer. They could do this kind of thing. I saw a burlesque performer in Adelaide who did a great dance to Copacabana. And then once she stripped down, her underwear was a xylophone.
Right.
And she played that at the end. And it was, or you know, one of those things where the audience just went, oh, that is very good. That is very good. So they could introduce, you know, some xylophone
She
magic.
Stole that from me.
Oh, really? This is awkward.
I'm a little disappointed.
Was that the ending to Colour Me
Yeah,
Judah?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And what I could do with my labia, who would have made your head spin? But, you know...
But do you remember, Jude, in the late, I think it was late 80s, early 90s?
Probably not, I'm thinking, just off the top of my head. It seems like a long shot, but let's go.
I remember word went around town that there was a bloke who had got up on stage at La Joke and taken a dump on stage. And you're going, what? Was that actually the act, or was it like a desperate
attempt?
Was it a comeback to a heckler? What circumstance?
See, it's interesting because
it's
I heard that that happened at La Mama, and that
right.
that was definitely a show that
right.
someone took a dump. But
right.
I heard, in terms of The Last Laugh, that a patron had taken a dump under a table.
Oh, really?
And who knows if they were a critic or just having a fun night at a Bucks night.
Could be both.
In the show, I mean, is it 8 shows a week? I mean, the pressure is on.
Yeah.
I would have thought,
yeah.
You know, is
well,
it
you're saying...
That's old material.
Yeah, I've seen this before. Hack.
You'd be wanting you just right at the start of the day, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's the one act that requires a good, healthy diet.
Mm.
Well, when did you guys first meet? What year was that?
Well, it was before... I remember the first time I saw Judith on stage.
And I remember the first time I saw you on stage.
Really?
But you take it away first.
I remember seeing you at the comedy club at the Hilton. Remember the Hilton in Melbourne? Now a Tats Lotto.
Yes.
Menu was a great American-style comedy club, and I saw Judith do an entire 20 minutes where the only subject was things that people had yelled at you from moving vehicles.
That was an old routine of mine. Thank you. Who else was on? Who would I have been supporting?
Man. Who would you have been on with? Maybe Fleety? Maybe, I think you were on with a man called Bob the Ape Man Burton. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, it does.
A man in a tuxedo who just impersonated an orangutan for
yes,
for
he kind
minutes.
Of went on to, like, direct festivals
right.
and things, Bob
right.
Burton.
Right.
But what was kind of fantastic about the Hilton, I can't believe I've put that sentence together. But is that most of the time there were American acts, and because of Actors' Equity in those days, they had to have two Australian supports.
Right.
So even if it was a kind of a waking nightmare, you would get like 6 weeks' work performing six nights a week, and you sort of got to be less shit. So that was...
Did you perform with Marc Maron when he came out? Marc Maron, who hosts WTF, talks about his experience in Melbourne being a nightmare.
I know of him, but yes. And of course, you know, my big line is one of the people I supported was Mark Price, who was Skippy from Family Ties, who I slept with.
Yes.
So that's my 6 degrees of separation with Michael J. Fox, which I think is fun for everybody. But the first time I saw you, it was at the ESPY.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And basically, I mean, obviously I knew about the DGEN, but I didn't know what you looked like. Right. I didn't know what you and Mick looked like.
At that time, I was called the Fat Man on radio.
Right.
So that allowed me to do stand-up with people not connecting that it was me.
Well, basically, you and Mick must have performed... Would you have performed together?
No, I don't think so. We were always two separate...
Right, so you would have gone on.
We were usually on the same night.
And I remember I was standing next to Greg Fleet, because I literally had no idea who you were, and you were both obviously really funny.
Right.
And I remember turning to Fleety, I'm assuming it's all right to swear on this.
Yeah. Of course it is.
And going, who the fuck are these guys? Yeah. Where have they come from? Because I can't, you know, I sort of knew everyone at that point, knew all the stand-ups. So you two just appeared out of nowhere and were really funny.
We were goaded into doing stand-up by people like Andrew Goodwin and Simon Rogers, because we had done TV and radio, but we hadn't proved ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this before. It was the rope.
Yes.
The night at the ESPY where you had to get... It was a filthy, oily rope hanging from the ceiling, and if you did old material, you had to go and hold the rope. And the audience would shout out rope if they heard you say something you'd said before. So we got in.
Yeah.
It was like, the way I describe it, it was like all the superheroes had lost their powers for a night.
Right,
Fleety couldn't do Shark Attack.
Yes.
So we got in. While that was happening, we snuck in. Otherwise, I don't reckon we would ever have done stand-up.
Yeah, right. So what year was this?
It was 1990.
How long have you been performing in
Melbourne? I started doing stand-up in 89.
Right. And did you start in Melbourne?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Oh, there was no comedy in Perth.
Yeah.
I always remember you did a show at La Mama called No Waiter... What was it?
I Ordered the Avocado.
And it didn't even have your name in the ad.
Not really.
It was
really
just the
well
name of the show
through.
was enough. Apparently they didn't have to say who was in it.
No, I had just... Moosehead money. So
yeah,
I got
right.
my Brian right. McCarthy Moosehead grant, and I did No Waiter, I Ordered the Avocado, which tragically is... You know those sort of... school annuals, and for your final year of high school you could put things under your name,
right,
and
yeah.
like most people did, you know, won the maths prize, and I put No Waiter, I Ordered the Avocado because it was a line from the Kenny Everett video show which I thought was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. Remember he did Star Quiz, where at the end of the show they would come back and people would have had the green gunk all over them, and for the life of me I can't even remember who the B grade celebrity was, but they just turned to the camera and went, No Waiter, I Ordered the Avocado.
Is that what that means?
And I simply thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
That wasn't Cliff Richard, was it? Like, Cliff
I think
Richard
I would have
lot...
remembered if it was Cliff. Cliff.
Yeah. He
I
had
think
a lot
it was
of
someone I didn't know who it was, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. The you got a moose head, was that for your first show?
Yes.
Yeah.
And can I say that the people I shared that with were a young impro group called the Flying Pikelets, starring Kevin White.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And what was, for people who might not know, Kevin White is the most powerful man in comedy. And what was he like as an improviser?
Well, he would, of course, feel sick at the very thought of the topic even being raised. So I'm pretty sure
Perfect.
It was he, Toby Sullivan and Angus Bell.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And maybe someone else. So, yeah. So I think Kev was 17.
Yeah.
So I met my now manager when... he had a bob hairstyle.
Yeah, right.
And was 17.
So the lesson is there's some people out there that I should be really nice to at the moment.
Pretty much.
I don't know what's going
on. You never know. But no, honestly, I do look back and go, if you had taken me aside and go, that guy's not only going to manage you, but a lot of people, I wouldn't have believed you. But you know what? He was always funny.
Yeah.
Kev was always hilarious.
Do you think it's time for a Pikelets reunion?
I think the nation's crying out for it.
Without a doubt. What would be good is to get him to apply for a Moosehead. What would happen? You know, when you started out here in Melbourne, what was the scene like? Because I think the scene now is, you know, sometimes comedians will talk about tough gigs. But I think audiences are so much more civil now.
Oh, without question. Yes.
Like a tough gig for a young comic now is a little bit like, oh, you know.
It's silence.
They didn't laugh as much.
Silence.
But back then.
Audiences are so polite, don't you reckon?
I think part of the key is venues like the local and the one that Charlie Pickering ran in Brunswick Street.
Oh, yeah, Stage Time.
Where there's couches and comfy chairs.
Yeah.
It's hard to get angry and heckle someone when you're in three-position comfort.
Yeah, really undermines it.
That's new. The chairs were much harder in our day.
But I remember a friend of mine said at the time, having seen me do another disastrous midnight show at La Jolla, she just went, comedy is the only Dickensian form of entertainment left.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if someone did a dump under a chair at the last laugh, but you know what? I believe it.
Yeah.
Because I remember nights when I was comparing the midnight show and I would honestly have to say, I'm sorry, the men will have to use the downstairs men's toilet because five people have projectile vomited in the upstairs ones.
Right.
People just drank until they vomited through their noses and lost consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
So that generally meant that they weren't necessarily connoisseurs of fine humour.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone say that on one of those warehouse comedy festivals. Yeah. Have to stop the show to give vomiting advice.
Yeah.
I remember I did a venue that was just so terrible. I did it with Anthony Morgan. It was actually one of the first gigs I ever did with Anthony, and it was burnt to the ground for following
Right,
week.
Yeah.
I remember another night at La Joke where I was getting heckled so much because I didn't shave under my arms that it actually gave birth to a famous routine of Anthony's.
Yeah.
Because this woman, she kept talking the whole way through my spot, and I finally went, what's the problem? And she went, my boyfriend thinks you're a lesbian because you don't shave under your arms. I can't remember what my hilarious response to that was. Probably because it was pretty early on, just fuck off. I very much doubt I had much else to give. But anyway, then Anthony came on and he'd managed to find some shaving cream and a spatula and started shaving his arms on stage and then just turned to the audience and said, I don't want that whole lesbian question hanging over me for the rest of the night. So, you know.
Yeah.
Out of adversity came some gold.
Was it, do you think there was like a stronger bond between comedians back then because of you know, audiences being a little bit more, you know, to be polite, audacious in the way they would approach a show? Because sometimes I feel now, you know, I'll be back announcing, oh, I'll be hosting a show and I'll build off a younger comic. And sometimes you can see the look in their eyes. They're looking as if to say, are you pulling the piss out of me? Are you having a crack?
Right.
But what it actually is I've paid attention to what you're doing and I'm just kind of making it a night. But I think it's because sometimes I feel like a lot of comedians now are auditioning for TV shows that don't exist.
Well, there was just less comedians around.
Yeah, that's really true.
I mean, I should have brought it in today, but I found the program for the 1991 Comedy Festival and it was a single sheet of A3 paper.
Right.
There were 45 shows.
Right.
I got out the program for this year and counted 45 in, and I wasn't even through B.
Yes.
So there were less comedians and there was less sense that your career was going anywhere. There wasn't any Rove or Glass House or Good News Week or shows really
big
to go
gig
on.
Hadn't started yet.
No. Well, there was the big gig, but
that was the first
was
thing
the
I ever did. But the idea of actually, and I know you came up through a different route than I did, but I mean the idea starting off as a stand-up, the idea that you could simply make a living out of doing stand-up comedy, that you got to hang out in bars every night and drink and this was your job, that was just fantastic.
Yeah, that's the victory.
So you know, you weren't actually thinking, oh, my God, I want my own chat show. No. Or you were just really grateful to be. I mean, I was in my early 20s getting drunk every night and this was work.
And there was a lot of venues, too. Yeah. There was the Dick and the ESP and the Last Laugh, etc.
And one of the great things about, you know, places like The Local and rooms that, you know, like Charlie ran or you know, what you and Adam are doing is fantastic, in that I think the quality is a lot higher, but it's really hard for people to make a living.
Yeah.
You know, whereas when you were doing like weeks at the Last Laugh, weeks at the comedy club at the Hilton, you didn't have to do anything else.
Yeah.
It was hard, but you actually got an actor's equity minimum wage that you could live off.
That sounds like something from a far off distance.
Well,
isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I feel Adam, Richard and I were talking about how it's really bizarre in this industry that you get less to appear at the Comedy Store now than you did 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, it seems to be going down.
How much is a standard appearance?
Off the top of my head, I think like a feature act is 200, and maybe the MC is like 100, 150, and the support is like $80. And if you want, I haven't performed there in like nearly 2 years because to have the honour of it, I have to fly myself up there and get some accommodation and make my way there back and forth. And it's like, well, you know, once upon a time when you were justifying, you know, being a better stand-up, then you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's fine. It's all part of the process. But I kind of feel, well, I'm better now. I don't need to do that. I quite like coin.
I've heard about in England where comedians actually have to pay to be on the show.
Really?
Oh, right.
Where they have there's certain chains where they'll book you if you can guarantee you'll bring 30 people along.
Oh, right. Wow. Yeah.
That's in America as well.
You've got to bring, like, 10 friends. And then what happens is you have a packed room, and if you're on later, I think the people who have less friends go on later, so you just watch the audience get smaller and smaller as each person finishes their spot, and their 10 friends go off to high-five them about how great they were, and until eventually, you know, you're performing to the next two acts.
So you see, it's swings and roundabouts, isn't it? Because the audiences were tougher, but they were there and you got paid.
And I remember doing, you know, 8 week seasons at the comedy club where you're doing 8 shows a week.
Yeah.
So if you're doing 64 shows in 8 weeks, anyone is going to get better.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to get better over that period.
Yeah. There are some acts that I've seen who will not butt that.
Maybe not the guy taking a crap.
You know? He ended up quite diminished by the end of it.
Right.
Who were your inspirations when you were starting off, Judith? Was there people that you looked to that you thought...
I mean, you have to understand that especially coming from Perth, where I had never seen live comedy before, but I mean, as you say, like the comedy festival years ago was only that many acts. But the first time I walked into the Last Laugh as a punter and saw Bob Down doing Pick a Hit, which was with Pete Rose Thorne and Gina Riley.
Yeah.
I saw The Found Objects, of course, went on to become Lanon Woodley. I saw The Natural Normans with, like, you know, Linda Gibson and Denise Scott and Sal Upton and Lynn McGranger. I saw Fleety doing stand-up. I saw Anthony Morgan doing stand-up. I saw The Cabbage Brothers. I just, you know, it was just incredible. I just thought I had died and gone to heaven. Even the waiters were wacky, but really, and they were all studying drama at VCA, people like Reese Muldoon.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was just like this kind of magical world. So I just wanted to be a part of that. So I was a fan of pretty much all of the people I've mentioned. I remember seeing Let the Blood Run Free for the first time. And that was, of course, with people like Pete again, but Brian Nankervis and Gene Kitson and, you know, David Swan. Just incredible talent.
And there seem to be more collaborations. Like, to kind of collaborate now seems to be like a real process. Do you know what I mean? Like, to get together with someone and suggest this or that. I often find when you're trying to do collaboration now, people are a little bit like, well, is this going to have me move to one side? Am I going to be kind of missing
that's
out on this?
Sad.
Yeah. And we've been trying to reintroduce the chat. Remember, you get the chat at the cheese shop.
Sure.
And you've seen this at the shelf. You know, like Adam Richard and I will get up and we've had like Will and we did the chat a couple of weeks before. Then before just going into the stand-up. Mm. And that's, I found that really fulfilling, actually. It's more exciting.
Well, I think part of it was in the 80s, there were big names. There was Mark Little, Anthony Morgan, Wendy Harmer, Richard Stubbs. But then when you got below that level, people were almost embarrassed to do a solo show.
Right.
So it was like, I remember word went round, oh, Tim Smith's doing a solo show, and everyone was... And what generally you did is you would just jump in with a bunch of people. Me and Mick Molloy did a show with Matt Quatermain and Greg Flea called The Show With No Name. And there were just a lot of shows like that where it was three or four people on the one show because people were almost, it was almost too egotistical to have your own name up there.
Whereas now, you'll have your solo show before you have a solid 10 minutes.
But I think it's also because, like, a lot of those guys came from, what was the place?
Rusden.
And I think a lot of them studied drama together too, so that they were coming up almost as groups there. You know, they'd work together as students and then they just continued on with it, really.
Yeah, right. What about you, Tony? What was the inspiration for you when you were
starting? Well, I remember, because there was a lot of big, colourful, you know, Let the Blood Run Free and stuff at the Last Laugh, people with trapezes in their shows, and it wasn't... I actually was...
Was it Marty Putz?
Marty Putz. People go nuts for Marty Putz. A lot of prop comedians... And I was, this was very unfashionable to say at the time, but I was really inspired by that season at Comedy Club at the Hilton where they brought out a lot of American comedians and it was just one guy or one woman with a microphone.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember at the time there was a lot of, you know, anger. Why do we need these people from overseas to come here?
Right.
But I remember Franklin Ajay was the guy who really inspired me, and he did this thing of taking small things and talking about them for what seemed like way too long.
Yeah, right.
So that was a big inspiration. And then another thing was me and Mick Molloy went to Edinburgh in 1991 and just got to see... We didn't go there to do a show. We just went there with Dave Taranto.
Yeah.
Dave Taranto was like our guide,
taking
us by the hand and just introducing us to all these... Bill Hicks, people we'd never seen or heard of before, and that was a big deal for me, coming back and going, because I remember when you start doing stand-up, you make a few rules for yourself. You go, oh, this doesn't work, oh, you can do that, but you can't do that. And I remember going to Edinburgh, and it was a 24-hour flight, and we got in at 4 o'clock, and at 6:30 that night, me and Mick were in the front row for Dennis Leary, who came out. And who was kind of a poor man's Bill Hicks. Really.
Yeah, that's
We got to see Bill Hicks later in the festival, and it was like, oh, that's what it should be.
Yeah, he's the mainstream Bill
Hicks.
That's
right. Dennis Leary was what we called the Sha-na-na version of Bill Hicks. But what Dennis Leary did that was interesting was Michael Landon. Remember Michael Landon, who was the star of Highway to Heaven?
Oh, yeah.
And Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
He had just died of cancer.
Right.
A day earlier. And Dennis Leary came out and opened his act with 10 minutes on why that was a good thing.
Right.
And somehow the audience went, like he managed to, the audience was shocked.
Yeah.
And then he dragged them into his idea.
Yeah.
And by the end, everyone agreed with him.
Yeah,
and I remember us thinking, well, every rule we had made for ourselves is bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, there are no rules at all.
I'm mad for hearing rules from young comics. Like when they say, I'll never do this. And you go, oh, well, okay then.
Like what?
Oh, you know, like...
what do they say?
Yeah.
Like one of my favourites is, you know, I'm never really going to talk about anything personal. And you go, oh, well, I can't
good
wait
luck.
To see your interesting career.
Right.
You know, you know, I don't want my stories to go too long. I just want them to be short, sharp and shiny. And then you see them and what they've done is they've thought of the first idea and they haven't fleshed it out whatsoever. It's always just interesting to see where someone makes a stand.
But why are they doing that? Because that will get them onto TV?
I think what happens is because of YouTube, before I saw your show at the Fringe, I hadn't seen stand-up. And then Fleety was the first comedian I'd seen in a club setting do stand-up. Before that, I'd heard Robin Williams on vinyl.
Sure.
And, you know, and I'd seen the Doug Anthony All-Stars live. So, you know, but now you can get it on YouTube, you can get DVDs, you can, you know, you can see so much. And now there seems to be, like, my favourite is good-looking young male comedians getting on stage who have obviously studied a lot and they know to play lower status. So they get up there and they're ripped and they're going, oh, I'm so awkward around women. And it's like, no, you're not. I know that you think that's a good thing to talk about, but you're pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like they know all the rules before we ever knew what the rules were, but therefore sometimes for a lot of them it sounds a little less authentic. And I think that's why someone like a Josh Thomas was a breath of fresh air because... you know, it just came from such a different place and a real place.
Mm.
Right. Well, the second you make any kind of rule, then the next comedy festival, someone's going to do the exact opposite and you're going to look like an idiot.
Don't you reckon we really didn't know what we were doing?
No,
I mean, I think that's...
Yeah. People are so much slicker now. Yeah. They've seen so many people on YouTube. Yeah. They know so much more stuff.
And there's a fear that your bad gig will be found out by lots of people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think we've talked about this before. When I was in the Bunta Boys, which was, you know, like, we were what we were. But we did a gig where we were angry at Bikes for Bibles for riding around and raising money. So we got an exercise bike on stage and got someone out of the audience to ride the bike backwards to keep money in Australia. And we did a whole show for an hour with this guy behind us and me with a ruler, whacking him on the knuckles, telling him off if he wasn't riding. And it was like, we had a guy just drawing attention for an hour. We didn't know you don't do that. It just seemed like a good idea. You know, lots of things that we would just put up on stage. And we were influenced by TV. So, you know, we were just trying to emulate, you know, the stunts that you would see in those kinds of shows, like the DJN and the big gig. And we were trying to do it live. But if I went back and looked at it now, even just talking about it makes me want to throw up in my mouth. You know, it feels really awkward.
But there was no one recording it on their phone and uploading it. So you could try it out over a few weeks.
Even me talking about it now sounds more romantic than it really was. You know, because, you know, you just fill it up. Yeah. But now I think everyone's like, you know, if you have a bad gig, next minute it's on Twitter, hashtag I saw such and such be an asshole. You know, it's on Facebook, people are filming it. I've seen kids put up spots where they've been heckled within an inch of their life and not dealt with it, and they've uploaded it to YouTube.
But why would you do that?
I don't know. I'm a little bit fascinated by it, to be honest. Like, there was a kid in Brisbane who I went on afterwards and tore this guy a new arsehole, but he died for like 7 minutes of this guy just being really aggressive, and he put up him dying and my 3 minutes of aggressive, I can't back any of this up in the real world retort. And then it got sent to me, I thought you might like to look at this. And I was like, no. And I look okay in it, and I don't want to see it, you know?
But what I also find really interesting, and I mean, you know, we're in our 40s. It's not like we're in our 90s.
No.
But it's like, if I had turned around to my careers teacher in high school when she said, what are you going to do? If I'd said, I'm going to be a comedian... You know, well, frankly, if I'd said anything other than nurse or physiotherapist, she just would have beat me up. But you know what I mean? It was not seen as a career path.
No.
And I was having this conversation with someone the other day, and not in any way knocking things like raw comedy or class clowns, but they were also saying, you know, all of these people are coming up now, and I don't know that there's the work for everybody.
No.
Which is the other thing.
Yeah, they're encouraging people to get into the business. That's always the fascinating thing of the Comedy Zone, which I think is a good idea. It showcases, you know, new and young comedians at the Comedy Festival. The fascinating thing is seeing the next year where they don't have the support of the festival and they're walking around and they're doing an hour show after doing a 10-minute spot the year before, walking around with way too many flyers and way too many posters, and they've got that faraway look in their eyes of, what happened? I had an audience every night, and there's a really kind of, it's kind of when I say fascinating, it's a bit heartbreaking, depending on if you really like the comedian or not. Yes. But it can be the next year, just seeing them wander around. It can be
This is the most old fartish thing that I will ever say. But I remember bumping into Trev Hoare, you know, Hoare, who ran SB Comedy for 10 years.
G'day, Tony.
G'day, Tony. Yeah.
And I bumped into him in about 2005. Yep. And I hadn't been doing stand-up for a couple of years. And I said to him, what's the difference between the comedians now and the ones from the early 90s? And he said, Tone, the difference is, as soon as they've got 10 minutes, they're going, why isn't Rove called?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know whether that's... Now, I don't want to tar everyone with the same brush, but, I mean, it's just, if that's your goal, I mean, that's a terrible goal to go, I've got to get onto television.
I've had young comics say that to me, you know, like 25, 26, when's it going to happen? I've been doing this for 5 years, but none of them have ever gone to try and get on at the Comics Lounge or the Comedy Club, which just seems like something that you should do because there's paid work there.
Absolutely.
You know, so like if you want to get this stuff happening, why don't you do this? But that's another one of the rules. I'm not going to perform certain rooms. Yeah. There's certain rooms that I am never going to perform
in. Good luck.
And in Australia, that's what you're saying is I'm going to have a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, man, I am just going to sound older by the second, but I remember I would actually walk down Brunswick Street and I would walk into pubs that didn't even have comedy, although a lot of pubs did just start having comedy in the 90s, but, you know, pubs where bands would play, and I would just walk in, say, can I speak to the manager and say, can I please go on and do 5 minutes between
the
bands?
Before a band.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it was often no picnic, but I mean, like, you were just doing anything.
It was just flying hours, and no one's ever going to see it. You know, no one had a phone that was filming it.
Yeah.
So that was the thing. You go, if it dies in the arse, who's going to know?
You know what you do? You just don't say what your name was at the end, and then you're fine.
That's right.
If it went bad, we used to say we were someone else. Like,
really?
I was in a duo, and we used to say, we've been Gary, and walk off.
I'm Dave O'Neill.
But the idea of going, well, I won't do that room, luxury.
Yeah.
But you know, the other side of that coin is, in the early 90s, you could get away with doing the same show for 5 years and just changing the name. The number of people who I've seen go, it's my 7th comedy festival show. And I go, no, it's your 2nd comedy festival show. It's your 7th name.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas now, people like yourself are doing a new hour every year. That's new.
That's the thing I love in America, where they're freaking out over Patton Oswalt and Louis C.K. They do a new show every year. And I think everyone in Australia just goes,
I know. Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
That's right.
Judith, can you remember the first show that you did where you thought, this is my voice? Like, not necessarily where you thought, I've polished it, but where you thought, I think things have really clicked together?
Oh, I think without question, King of the Road, I reckon.
King of the Road, yeah.
Well, essentially, I'd done The Late Show, which was, without question, my big break.
Yeah.
And basically, I really hadn't put together that if you've been on television, they will come.
Yeah.
So, in fact, my manager said to me, and I like to say, I know I've got a manager, but even Coles has a manager, because you can't say you've got a manager without saying like a wanker. But anyway, he said to me, no, look, I reckon you can do a show... Lower Town Hall Comedy Festival, which held 280 people, and I just went, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No one will come. And I was overseas at the time. I just found out I was adopted. It was a pretty strange period in my life.
Yeah.
So I came back to do the show, and I thought, well, all I can really talk about is the fact that I'm adopted and tell stories about my disastrous trip overseas. And I actually got a director who's a really good friend of mine, and we just showed slides and I did a tap dance. And it was the first time I kind of had a notion of you could put on a show, you know, that it didn't, you could actually do more than, I guess I'd done a lot of just straight stand-up and a lot of comedy clubs, and this was the first time I...
And it was one of the first shows like that. I mean, now everyone has a personal story to tell in 55 minutes, but there wasn't a lot of that going on at the time.
No, that's kind of true. Like, I remember Fleety did something like that year too. It was like I was...
was the year of tie-dye, maybe?
Yeah, it might have been, So I guess that was the first time, and the first time it ever entered my head that people might buy a ticket to come and see me if I wasn't just on a bill with 50 other comedians.
Yeah,
so that was just, you know, the fact that I didn't kill myself at the end of that season was a real breakthrough.
it's a good album of that show, too, that you can find at Dixon's.
Three people in the country own.
Got to bring it back. The kids will be onto it. They'll download it. We talked a bit about this earlier today. You know, when talking about other people and then, you know, putting it into your stand-up. Is there any kind of moments where you sort of second-guess that a little bit? Because I know sometimes in the past I've been a little bit laissez-faire about, you know, talking about something about my mum. And then, you know, a few years later going, well, I don't know if she really wanted me to tell everyone that. Has there been anything where you sort of...
Well, we've had this conversation before because you think about it a lot when you write books too.
That's right. Well, I've got the advantage of being in another country.
Yes.
So most of, you know, occasionally I'll get an email from my mum going, where are my royalties for that good scissors business? But apart from that, most people, once I change the names, I mean, I don't know whether you do this, I always slightly change people's names.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a lot of trouble, but Jude, surely.
Well, I've... had a little bit of trouble, but you know this from the radio though, it's never what you pick. You know, you might actually be beside yourself about something thinking, oh, you know, Jesus, I hope this person doesn't hear about this.
Then
they're fine. And it's something that you say that you haven't even thought twice about.
Yeah,
that people will get up in arms about. You had that with Martin Malloy, didn't you?
Well, we had, I remember on the when we did the old Degeneration Breakfast show, there was, I've got to be careful what I say, but there was a rumour going around about Jennifer Kite, a newsreader.
Right. Yes.
And it was actually spread by the late Shirley Strawn, but because he was a ski reporter on our show, we just got the blame for spreading this vile rumour. And in the end, we made a joke about it where we named Marty Roan, who was a singer who had a song called Denim and Lace, the follow-up Mean Pair of Jeans. And we made a throwaway joke about his song, that thing where you pretend that you go, oh, we've made a lot of jokes about this celebrity and you think it's going to be this one, and it's this one.
Yeah.
And Marty Roan was the guy who ended up suing us.
Oh, right.
So you just, the people, it always comes from where you least expect it. You know, you've got your guns facing that way, and then what's this arrow in the back of my neck? And you know, you've been shot by the singer of Mean Pair of Jeans.
I mean, my theory has always kind of been, I don't think I put shit on anyone more than I do on me. So that's kind of my safety net. But, like, I mean, ultimately, I guess my kicker story is that, I mean, I obviously talked about my parents a lot while they were still alive. And especially if a story was not that savoury, I would actually ring them up. And I remember asking Dad if I could tell a story about what happened on Christmas Day and him trying to punch my brother's lights out. And he literally said, go for your life.
Right.
He really... So, you know, no problem.
Yeah.
Cut to 6 weeks before he died, and I was doing a show in Perth where I used to crack a joke about my father's testicles. And basically, it wasn't even about his testicles. It was actually about my best friend's father's testicles, which was unusual for me because, you know, normally it's all about my family or whatever. Anyway, Mum and Dad never really came and saw me, but there was a review in the West Australian which actually quoted this joke word for word. And I said to Dad, jokingly, at a delightful family meal, I went, Dad, just so you know, they're not even your testicles. And Dad actually used to have a great sense of humour. Like, in the past, he would have just thought that was funny. He didn't think it was funny, and he disowned me by fax the next day.
By fax.
And then he died.
Right.
So
you know, if anything happens with anyone else, whatever, right?
Pretty much.
Wow. Was he... I don't quite understand, what was he upset about, that it was not his testicles, or was he upset that
it was in a review, wasn't it?
I think so.
It's not so much it was in the show, but that joke was quoted.
Yes. Right. And look, I mean, Dad, you know, look, it's a long story, and I don't think Dad was entirely himself for quite some time before he died. But no, I literally, you know, left that lunch, thought, oh, well, Dad was a bit shitty about that, whatever.
Yeah.
Went out to lunch the next day, came home from that lunch, and there was a fax under the door that simply said, you are no longer my daughter.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but you, and didn't see that one coming, Justin.
No.
So,
not
yes,
at all.
You can never pick it.
We have to wrap up, but.
That seems like a bad note to end.
Yes, I was getting the wrap up over there, and I was thinking, this is awkward. This is really
out on Judith's dad's balls.
No, there's no way we can do that. What's the show about this year, Judith?
Well, it's called Nothing Fancy, and that's really it in a nutshell. It's just gags. You know, if you've ever seen me, I'm a one-trick pony. All I ever do is bang on about what's either happened to me or what I've been thinking about since the last show. So that's it, really.
And it's been 2 years since the last show?
Three.
See, I was talking to Judith about this, Tony. The lesson I've learned. One of the lessons I've learned from Judith is you don't need to do a show all the time.
No. And well, I remember you did 3 shows in 1 year one time. So
I did not have a media job.
Sure. Now, that is madness.
Could have bought you a bit of time there.
I really could have been living off that for a long time. That literally came from, you know, I don't do anything else. So I had a lot of energy.
But I think that raised the bar for. I don't think anyone's ever done 3 shows at one festival.
I think Anthony Morgan did.
Oh, right.
He did. Ink Pink, You Stink.
Ink Pink, You Stink.
Yes,
but,
he did.
But these were shows that all. I think my continuity was a bit nerdier.
Yeah. And probably Anthony Morgan. I think they've done 3 or 4 shows.
They've done many shows. Yeah, sometimes you don't even have to buy a ticket. You can just be at the bar.
But when you were doing that year, did you think I'm insane?
No, I was working with Paul Horan, the delightful Paul Horan, as director, and you know, he was taking great pleasure in keeping me slightly off balance. But you know what was great about it was you never had that mid-season slump. You know, normally you get to Suicide Wednesday and you're going, what? But because you had an opening night every week, you never got into a rhythm where you started to get bored with the show. So that was quite exciting. I won't do it again, but as a one-off, it was good. Well, what do you have coming up next, Tony?
Well, I'm working with Wayne Hope and Robin Butler.
Oh, great.
Who did The Librarians. And, of course, you were in the... Do a lot of your viewers and listeners realise that you've done acting, Justin?
Yeah, you know what? I've had the occasional biscuit from people
really?
Going past.
Because you had a wig of some kind on. Oh, that was in the flashbacks.
In the flashbacks, I got to wear a mullet. And in the real world, I got to wear some very flattering costumes that made me look like an accountant.
Well, as you know, Wayne and Robin are, you know, if they make the call, you've just got to do it because they're the nicest people to work with. There's no bullshit with them.
Jeez, how giving is Wayne Hope to perform to? Like when you're looking at him on screen and the way he looks at you just completely believe everything.
Well, he's the director who's done it himself, and he doesn't play any games with people, and you always know what he thinks. And all I'm saying is if you get a chance to work with them, you should always say yes.
Yeah, can you say what it is, or it's a bit...
It's involving, what can I say? It's involving family disputes, Jude, so I feel at home.
Yeah, something we can all feel, that we can relate to.
If you've got a family that has an angry Christmas, I think you're going to enjoy this show.
Oh, good, it should be a ratings bonanza then.
Yes.
Well, Tony, Judith, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.